This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Something a little different for you today. We'll talk to an expert forager about taking advantage of what Mother Nature provides without you having to plant it. Sam Thayer is back with us. He's an internationally recognized authority on edible wild plants. He's been teaching classes and workshops around the United States for about three decades. His award-winning foraging books include Sam Thayer's Field Guide to Edible Wild Plants of Eastern and Central North America. Hi there, Sam.
Hi, Jill. I'm almost as excited to be here as I am about spring itself.
Well, we're excited also for both of those. And if you have been experimenting with foraging, or you have a question about what to eat out there in the wild, why don't you give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email, talk@wpr.org. So, Sam, I was wondering, how did you acquire your knowledge about foraging? When did that start?
Well, you know, when I was a little kid, I just remembered anything about tree food. And so, foraging wasn't that kind of as a name for the topic. That didn't really exist so much when I was a kid. But we had a black walnut tree two houses down from us. And my dad showed me that I could eat the black walnuts. And then my grandmother and my grandfather, they had two black walnut trees in their yard. So that's one of the first things I learned. And there was a butternut tree across the road in someone else's yard. And I got permission to pick those. And my parents showed me those. So, but I just never forgot those things. And I just built on it. And I was just fascinated. So it was largely self-taught, but I picked it up from people here and there until I was 10. And I discovered this little booklet, Bradford Angier's Guide to How to Live in the Woods. And that had about 40 wild edible plants in it. And I was like, my mind was blown. I was like, wow, this stuff is in a book. And then I started realizing there was other books about it. So I certainly had people I learned from in my childhood. But it was mostly self-taught through books. And I just slowly accumulated it. And I was obsessed. You know, some kids are obsessed with trains. And I was obsessed with, birds and reptiles and amphibians and plants that I could eat especially.
Not the birds and amphibians that you could eat, just the plants?
You can eat some birds and amphibians, right. But I was interested in them because I just was fascinated. I'm still an avid bird watcher,
sure.
And still an avid amphibian watcher and reptile watcher, but the one that ended up being my career, I guess, and the central focus of my life was foraging for plants.
Yeah, because it really has, hasn't it? Now, did you go to school advanced education for this?
I did not. Okay. I mean, I studied botany so earnestly as a teenager, but when it came time, I had this dream. I was going to go live off the land, and I worked through high school and saved up money. And so when I was 18, I bought 60 acres, an abandoned dairy farm, and built a little cabin on it. And that was my dream. And I thought I'll do anything for work to support my addiction to foraging. And, so I spent, 10 years working, I would say lower level jobs in the economy and foraging both, and slowly worked into teaching about it, as a profession. That happened, it was a gradual process.
I love that. That's a wonderful story. How did your parents react to you running around eating weeds and things?
Well, my mom was very against me collecting mushrooms. Other than morels, because that was the one wild mushroom that she knew. My dad was a little bit, just said, well, I just trust him. Just do whatever you want. But as far as the plants go, my mother was more tolerant of that because her mother foraged a little bit in different wild berries, and I didn't realize till I was an adult how much my grandmother knew. She knew a ton about foraging, but I only saw her about once a year, and she didn't share as much with me. She didn't know that I was so interested, ironically. So my mom allowed me to collect lots of plants kind of at will. She trusted me there, but she didn't trust me with mushrooms until I was about 16.
Well, I think she's justified on that mushroom thing. That's very easy to make mistakes with those. So,
It's a little easier with mushrooms than it is with plants to make mistakes. But somebody with a good head on their shoulders is going to be fine in either realm, as long as they're following the same guidelines of you just eat something when you're absolutely certain mm-hmm. of its edibility status and of its identity, what it is. So mushrooms are slightly trickier, but anyone with a good head on their shoulders can handle mushrooms too.
Okay, great. Well, we have a call already from Sabi in Middleton. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, good morning. I also learned how to look at these plants and figure out which one was edible from my mother, who also taught me how to cook. She's a Palestinian-born American, and I learned from her everything I know about cooking and foraging for things. Porcelain, or purslane, depending on how you read it and pronounce it, is a succulent that is prevalent here in Wisconsin. People eradicate, fight it, and try to kill it. It is a delicious succulent that is relatively undiscovered here in the U.S., and it has a lot of omega-3 fatty acid, and it's really, really good for you if you know how to cook it. So I hope that was included in your work. And if you know anything about purslane, and when I share with the listeners, it's P-U-R-S-L-A-N, I believe. So our dandelions that are eradicated and fought vehemently, my neighbors look at my lawn full of dandelion, and they accuse me of letting the seeds fly everywhere. But if you pluck those in the right time of year, you don't even have to go look for those. They're everywhere. And if you pick them just the right amount and you know how to take the bitterness out and saute them, they make a delicious vegan, vegetarian, or dishes with meat.
Okay. Go ahead,
well,
Sam.
I'm glad that our caller brought up two of my favorite wild edibles. So as far as purslane, that is one of the most widespread native plants in the world. For many years, it was believed that purslane was not native to North America, that it was brought by Europeans. But then archaeologists started finding purslane in archaeological sites and realized, no, this is native here also. So that's a common disturbance-dependent plant and with a fascinating life history. It's that, you know, small plant likes garden soils, disturbed soils, especially where it's sandy with the thick, succulent leaves. And purslane photosynthesizes partly through what they call crassulic acid metabolism, where it stores, it creates crassulic acid during the day, and then it converts that to sugar at night, because in doing that, it loses less moisture. So it's a very, it's adapted to high moisture stress, high temperatures and low soil moisture. And it's all over the world. It's native to Australia, Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Americas, and high in iron, and just a incredibly easy plant to work with. So if you look online, you can find tons of recipes for purslane, and it's incredibly easy to identify. So that's a great starter plant for people, because many people have it in their yard, and you don't have to go far to find it generally. Most gardeners are already quite familiar with it. Easy to incorporate into your diet. But it's a hot weather plant. We won't see it appearing in Wisconsin usually until late May, and in some places not till mid-June, because it doesn't like it until it gets at least about 75 degrees out, maybe 80. And dandelion, well, dandelion season is right now.
Yes.
And you know, they're not blooming yet here in northern Wisconsin, but they are in southern Wisconsin. And one thing we do with dandelions is before they bloom, and the flower buds are clustered at the base, right at ground level, and a lot of people don't notice the dandelions at this time, but we'll take a spoon and gouge out this whole cluster of dandelions, and it's like an artichoke. And the thing is, we can return to the same dandelion plants year after year. A lot of people don't realize that a dandelion plant can live for a century. I mean, there's ones we've been gouging out for 15 years.
Wow.
And you gouge out those flower buds, and then we steam them, and just, I mean, they're just this mild artichoke-like vegetable, with this faint, you know, lettucey bitterness, but it's faint and pleasant. Oh, I mean, I love those dandelion hearts. We call them the gougers. And then shortly after that, we'll harvest the leaves. Now, the key to having dandelion leaves be fantastic as a vegetable, I think there's three key things. One is get them when they're young before the dandelions bloom. And not so much for flavor, but for texture, because when the leaf is still expanding, it's extra tender. The flavor is better, but the texture is much better. The second thing is I don't pick the base of the dandelion leaf. So I use scissors and I cut it. I take the outer two-thirds and I leave the base. So people talk about the bitterness in dandelion leaves, and before you're accustomed to that bitter flavor, it's off-putting to some people, but it's faint in the spring, and the strongest bitterness is in the base of the leaf, so I take the outer part of the leaf. And then the other one is so many traditional dandelion recipes from around the world fry dandelion, and it could be with olive oil, plant oil, and very often it's with pork, you know, dandelions, onions, and bacon go together. And you know, if you have a healthy source of bacon, that's a really healthy way to cook dandelion. So I love dandelion greens, young ones in the spring, fried with onions and maybe a few other greens. If you've tried them and you didn't like them, but you didn't do it in early spring like that, and you didn't fry them, try them again.
Now, that's key to a lot of the plants you forage, is you have to pick them at the right time.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't realize that we have bred our domestic vegetables to hold themselves in this kind of peak form. So like a head of lettuce, a wild lettuce plant forms a head just like a domestic lettuce head. But the domestic holds that head for like a longer time. The wild lettuce is only in this head form for like 3 to 5 days. And if you don't get it that window, boom, you missed it. But the other side of that coin is the wild lettuce is actually better at that point because it's not artificially kind of bred to hold itself there. So you get a better head of lettuce if you identify wild lettuce at the perfect time. It's better than any romaine. That's specifically our Canada lettuce or Lactuca canadensis, or what in our house we call the good lettuce. that one is better than any romaine you can buy if you hit it just right. So a lot of these wild things, the timing is really, really critical.
Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that you can look up, like in one of your books or other sources. They'll tell you when to pick it, right?
Well, I try to go into detail for all that stuff in my books, because mm-hmm. one of the things that frustrated me as a young forager is I would be told, you can eat wild lettuce. Oh, boy, how many times did I have to try it before I found a way that I liked it? And I realized, okay, it's safe anytime. But if I want one of my friends to share it or my mom to be willing to eat a bite, you know, I need to make this good. So I had to figure out what's the right time and also what's the right species. There's actually sometimes it's complicated. We have 6 or 7 wild lettuces in Wisconsin, and 2 of them are very good and 2 are pretty good, and the others are not really very good. So there's stuff to figure out to get the culinarily the best experience.
We're talking with Sam Thayer, an internationally recognized authority on edible wild plants. What questions do you have about foraging? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Hope you can stay with us in the second hour of the show. We'll talk with insect expert PJ Leash about what insects can do for your garden. Right now, we are talking about foraging. Sam, it seems like the interest in foraging has kind of increased quite a bit in the last decade or so. Have you seen that?
Yeah, it seems to. And it seemed to start around the Great Recession, 2008-2009, a strong rekindling of interest in foraging. And then it was got another boost with COVID, and all outdoor activities kind of – there was a lot more attention for that summer. Everything outdoors was crowded. But there does seem to have been a steady increase. There's been an increased perception that food is important. You know, we have the slow food movement and organic food movement, and this is kind of part of that. Like, return to our roots. Like, we have enough food now. Let's look for the best food.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Well, let's go to the phones, because we have Nettie in Fond du Lac who has a comment about a couple of wild edibles. Go ahead, Nettie.
Hi, Sam. I am hoping someday to come up and take classes with you, but your story sounds just like mine. I'm 75, though, and I had no way of learning except, you know, on my own. Then I met Grandmother Kiwetinohkwe, and oh my, a ton from her, especially, you know, the importance of learning to connect with the plants and to listen to them. Are you safe to listen to? But the ones that I would really like to talk about, first of all, is stinging nettles. And there are many variety of stinging nettles. The ones that are really good to eat are the Urtica dioica. Those are the ones with the great big heart-shaped leaves. And, oh, my gosh, I can pick them without getting, you know, bare-handed, but that's a trick to that. The other ones, the little sword-shaped ones, those are so fibrous that it's really not the best idea to...
Oh, I think we lost her. I'm sorry, Nettie. Maybe you can call back and we can finish up with that. But comments, Sam?
Well, you know, I love your listeners. nettles, again, one of my absolute favorite plants. And one thing that's great about nettles is I have a garden, my wife and I have a garden, and we very much love our garden. But you get some spring things that come up so fast, and, you know, they're just waiting. And stinging nettles are a frost-resistant plant. They can freeze solid, and they're just fine. So they're already up statewide, just barely in the far north, but they're up. And, I mean, this, you know, this rich, hearty flavor and this really high-protein green that's extremely digestible, and it just feels so wholesome. I mean, it's one of the things I can't wait for in the spring. Stinging nettles, you can make soup out of them. You can saute them. You know, we'll just steam nettles and just sprinkle them with salt and a little butter. And they're just, you know, they're just so great and wholesome by themselves. There's a million recipes that you can find online for stinging nettles. And it sounds like Nettie was describing two species of nettle common in Wisconsin that sting, the wood nettle and stinging nettle, both of which are native. The wood nettle is the broader heart-shaped leaf. And I, like Nettie, prefer that one very much. It's more tender than the classic stinging nettle, which is also found in Europe. The wood nettle is only in North America. So we have better nettles in Europe. but anyways, the stinging nettle, you have to be more careful to get it smaller and younger so that it's more tender. The wood nettle is tender, longer, and at a larger size. But I think they're both excellent.
And again, you want to pick them like this time of year when they first start coming up?
Well, they're best right now.
Okay.
The wood nettle will come up a little later. It's not frost resistant like the stinging nettle.
Okay.
But both of them are ideal in the spring, but you can use the greens later in the growing season. When the plants start flowering, the greens get kind of a gritty texture, and I'll use them for tea at that time, but I'm not going to use them as greens once they have flowers on
okay.
them.
Now, the other thing that Nettie wanted to bring up was chickweed. Do you use that?
Oh, yeah. Now, chickweed is excellent. And like nettles, chickweed is a group. So we have at least four or five native chickweeds in Wisconsin, or chickweeds, some of which are native and some of which are not. And every one of them is good. They range from good to also very good. And we have a small native one called stitchwort that has a square stem and paired leaves that is a very cold-resistant native chickweed, and it's perennial. And if you find a carpet of that, I just cut them with scissors. And chickweeds all have a flavor that reminds me of fresh corn silk, like if you took the corn silk and ate it when the corn wasn't quite ripe. And I really like that flavor. Then we have common chickweed, which is mostly in urban areas and gardens. And that like plant likes cool weather. And you'll see that. So that's also coming into its own right now. Peaks probably mid-May. Great salad plant. All the chickweeds are great salad plants. You can cook them, but they're so dainty, they almost disappear. And then we have one called water chickweed, which is probably the most common chickweed in Wisconsin that foragers collect. And that's the largest of our chickweeds. And it's really common in the driftless area and in most of southern Wisconsin in like slightly sunny forest edges and openings. And that was the one that when I lived in the Madison area, I collected a lot as a teenager. The water chickweed. So all chickweeds And I can't teach you to identify them over the phone, but they all have a flower with white petals, five white petals, but each one is split in two, so it looks like 10. So when you see that pattern, there's a very good chance you have a chickweed, and they're a pretty easy group to recognize.
Okay. Let's go back to the phone then. Suzanne in Black Creek, what do you have for us?
Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering, in regards to the wet lettuce, I'm looking to use it for pain relief, and I was wondering if that's best orally, or can use it orally and topically, and is it just best I could dry it, or do I, you know, make it into a tea right away? Could you explain maybe some of that for me, please?
Okay. So I'm not an expert on the medicinal use of the plant, but I will tell you what I know about this. I do have a friend who has a severe chronic injury that he takes lettuce, wild lettuce, makes his own extract as pain relief. And he uses the prickly wild lettuce, which is one of our non-native lettuces, and it's one of the more strongly flavored ones. He uses that in the midsummer when it's mature. And then he cooks it down and makes some sort of concentrate with it. I can't give you all the details on that. The problem is I eat every day, so I know a lot more about food than medicine, which I don't use nearly as often. but I would say that would be a good starting point, and there's some fairly good instructions online for it. And the lettuces that I find the best for food are the ones that are least used medicinally, which makes sense because the medicinal components tend to be associated with the stronger flavors and the plants at maturity. But that prickly wild lettuce should be easy for you to find almost anywhere in Wisconsin, and it has a prickly base to the leaf, which is very distinct, and a prickly stem. And I won't go further into details that I don't know and mislead you, but that plant, I would say midsummer, and make sure you use preferentially that lettuce as opposed to the other ones.
Okay. Thank you, Susan. We appreciate that call. David Appleton, you're up next. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting program. So I'm wondering if you can eat Creeping Charlie or Creeping Jenny, and how about Ramp? It's a type of wild onion. And please, there's two more, hostas and daylilies.
Okay. Well, I'll save the Ramp for last.
Okay.
and I will say Creeping Charlie is edible. It's a mint family plant. It's mostly used as a flavoring, not so much as an ingredient you would use in any significant amount. I think that I scared away a friend in sixth grade by cooking something with way too much Creeping Charlie in it. and so something to be aware of, it is a strong flavor. And it's not my favorite flavor now that I know a lot more foraged flavors. I have a friend in France who adores that plant and uses it a lot in cooking, and has made drinks with it that she has served to me that I thought were excellent, and I would not have conceived of that use of the flavor. So think of that Creeping Charlie as a flavoring plant more than as a food plant, but perfectly safe, and it's a strange mint. Think of it that way. And then hostas. Hostas aren't wild. Hosta young tender greens are edible. I've eaten them a few times. But I don't have hostas in my yard, and so I have not used them extensively. Ellen Zakos is a great foraging author that has a backyard foraging book with a more extensive chapter on using hostas for food, and she's also a great cook, so that might be a place to look there. There's one more he mentioned that I forgot.
Daylilies.
Daylilies. Okay, daylilies are a very controversial wild edible. They're very known. Well, they're very well known as a wild edible. They also make some people have gastric upset or diarrhea. And so there are different varieties and hybrids of daylilies, and some of them are apparently not safe. So I grew up eating daylilies without any problems. But there are people who get sick when they eat daylilies, and this is in my foraging workshops, I do not allow participants to eat daylilies. Because I know eventually somebody will get sick from it. I know other older, more seasoned foraging authors who've told me when I was starting out, don't don't let people eat daylily in your classes, you know, and I think that was wise. So I eat them with no problem. Just the common orange daylily. My favorite part is the flour. I'll saute the flowers and I feed that to my family. We've never had a problem. But I go to the same patches again and again. But any weird looking daylily that looks anything other than the normal common orange daylily, I would shy away from that. And I would just recognize that some people get ill from daylilies. And finally, he mentioned ramps,
yes,
which is something I wanted to talk about. So ramps are a native wild onion, and they are very common in Wisconsin. Not everywhere in Wisconsin, but generally statewide, they're common. This is a great wild edible, and I have lots of them on my property, and we eat them on a regular basis. So the name ramps, it comes from there's European wild onion that's ecologically fairly similar that is called Ramson in England. We dropped the second syllable here, but we named our very similar wild onion Ramps, also called wild leeks by a lot of people in Wisconsin. And there is a fairly vigorous online debate. This is a controversial wild edible because some people say it's not sustainable to harvest ramps. There are places where people are unsustainably over-harvesting wild ramps from public land. And that needs to stop, and it should not be happening, as with any other over-harvesting. But someone who is a responsible harvester of ramps and follows some basic guidelines, which is, you know, when I harvest a ramp patch, I will take about half of what's there every 4 or 5 years. And I've been harvesting from the same patches for decades, and I watch, right? And how much you can harvest depends on a number of factors, such as what is the competition. I know where I have a lot of trout lily or Pennsylvania sedge with my ramps, for example, two common plants that grow with it. They'll prevent the ramp regeneration. I can't harvest as much in those places, or I'll actually pull out some of my Pennsylvania sedges to allow the ramps to regenerate. So there's a lot to consider there, but it can definitely be done sustainably harvesting. And I guess when I say 50%, I'm harvesting whole plants, bulbs and tops included, which is how ramps are generally traditionally harvested. But you can also harvest just the leaves. When you harvest just the leaves, you prevent the plant from flowering over the long term. If you do it 1 year, you won't. But if you harvest, you know, the leaves year after year, but you generally won't eliminate your patch. So I recommend with either one, harvesting leaves or harvesting bulbs, do it judiciously. Don't take all that's there, and keep your eye on your patch where you're harvesting. And also do things to promote your ramps. I will grab some seeds and plant them in a new location that looks like just the right habitat, but there's none there. And I'm positive that I account for many, many times more ramps existing than I have, you know, eaten in my life. So it's something that you can do sustainably. And when you find a good ramp patch, cherish it, because it's just a great early spring vegetable, extremely nutritious, extremely tender. And, you know, it's an oniony green. It's not as strong as chives. And there's some volume there. And so it's really kind of hearty. You can, you know, we will fry ramps and then have them with duck eggs in the morning, for example. And we love that. We make ramp soup. We'll put them in stir fry with lots of different vegetables. I'll put a ramp leaf on a sandwich or a couple ramp leaves. I don't ferment ramps, but I have a friend who does, who gives me a jar every now and then. They're fantastic. There's so many things you can do with it.
Yeah, wild leeks are, well, I grew up calling them wild leeks, but ramps, but they're wonderful. We use them all the time in the spring. So, yeah, what a great, and you do research on them, don't you? I noticed that on your website.
Yeah, so we have, this is the 18th year since I put in my first research plot, and I have an area in my sugar bush where I make maple syrup. It used to be dominated by hemlocks. The hemlocks were cut out. The maples have taken over. And things like ramps and these forest understory plants, they move slowly. So I had a big area that was good ramp habitat with no ramps in it. So I thought, here's a perfect opportunity for me to plant ramps and then monitor their growth rates. And this has kind of ballooned into a whole bunch of different experiments and just observational studies. And I keep I need to get these finished and get them published. But I'm like, each year I'm like, wow, new data. So what I found is I put in 85 bulbs. This will be the 18th year. I'm going to have about 3,500 plants from the original 85. So in 18 years in my first study plot. And what I found is the competition makes a big difference in how fast they reproduce. And what I found is the soil disturbance of harvest really helps the seed germinate. So if you have a good patch and you harvest it, but not over harvest it, it creates ideal opportunities for germination for new seeds. And the harvested patches produce a lot more seeds and flowers than the unharvested patches, because like anything in your garden, you know, if it's too dense, it's not going to thrive and it's not going to produce much fruit. So those are kind of the basic takeaways from the research I've done.
And if you want to check that out, Sam's website is called foragersharvest.com. Lots of info there. And there's a whole page of stuff on ramps. So if you're interested, you can delve deep into that one. So thanks for the comment, Dave. Let's go to Jeff in Evansville. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Great. Thanks for the call.
So I've been marching around outside, and I located my stinging nettle. I've got a little thing that I do in my greenhouse where I spread my compost in December and then put the covers on my cold frames in there and water them real good. And I've been eating lamb's quarters for about almost a month now. So tonight I'm going to make a lamb's quarters and stinging nettle sag paneer. I've also got some mustards that got away from me that I'm going to go through and clip too. And I'll tell you what, it is delicious.
That sounds great. And I'm excited for you. I'm actually coming to Southern Wisconsin today, and I'm hoping I can get some greens ahead of what we have up north and bring them home and make some big green-based dishes. And I love what you said. Is it Jeff?
Yes.
The caller, in that, you know, people often think of like foraging and gardening as if they're opposed. And that's really kind of a strange new idea. I mean, historically, all over the world, almost every society, there were people gardened and people farmed, small-scale farming. People combine foraging and gardening, and they get the best of both worlds. You know, you don't forage out of an emergency because you're starving. I mean, you could, but most foraging that takes place is because it gives people the best combination of food, and it increases the diversity of what you can eat. And you know, we think of foraging sometimes as like emergency food, but it's also gourmet food. I mean, maple syrup, ramps. These are things that you'd pay a lot of money for if you bought. You get to have the best food in the world for free if you have a little bit of knowledge by both gardening and foraging.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. Appreciate that. Enjoy your meal this evening. That brings me to one question that we may want to talk about, in that if you're foraging in your backyard or, you know, near where people might be treating lawns, you have to be pretty careful, don't you?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I'm kind of excited, and I would have just talked about all the plants I'm excited about and forgot this basic detail. People often think of misidentifying plants as like the biggest fear of foraging, but people have really good common sense and very rarely eat something they haven't identified well. I mean, those kind of poisons are exceptionally rare. But the bigger fear that I tell beginning foragers about, and that I certainly worry about more myself, is making sure that you are not eating plants sprayed with herbicide. And one of the hardest parts about this is that our cultural relationship to herbicide is changing. We use it way more now than we did 30 years ago. And 70 years ago, it was hardly being used. And so we don't have a good set of cultural norms around herbicide use, and I can't give you a rule for foraging to how you know something hasn't been sprayed with herbicide, except know the spot you forage from. I'm lucky that I forage on my own land, or I have, you know, neighbors. But in the national forest, for example, if you're going to go pick blueberries, and if they're going to spray herbicide in an area, you know, where there might be blueberry pickers, they're generally going to post that. And I, you know, but we're having some faith here that it hasn't been sprayed without being posted. So that's my biggest fear. I wish I could tell your listeners there's this one rule. But you need to just use common sense in assessing where people may or may not have sprayed. And when in doubt, don't eat or ask, you know, someone.
Sure. We're talking with Sam Thayer, an internationally recognized authority on edible wild plants. What questions do you have about foraging? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us again on Monday on The Larry Mueller Show. We'll talk with sports journalist Pete Doherty about his impressions of this week's draft in Green Bay. And then we'll take a look at training for a marathon. In the last half hour, we'll hear from the weather guys. So lots of really fun stuff to talk about on Monday. Right now, we're talking about foraging. Sam, we did have a call from Bob who couldn't stay with us. And he says that he knows that you love wild plants. Plums, and he wants to know when is the best time to harvest them.
Okay, well, we have two species of native wild plum in Wisconsin. We have the American plum and the Canada plum. They're both statewide, but the Canada plum is much more common in the north. And the Canada plum, now I'm just going to just say, imagine Wausau or the center of the state for these times I'm giving. And then if you're in the far north, you're going to add a week and a half to that. If you're in the far south, you can subtract a week and a half. But the Canada plum, say at Wausau latitude, is going to ripen generally about August 15th to 20th. And the season is not it's fairly long, but it's not a long season like apple season. There's about a 2 week period. And then the American plum, the peak ripening is about September 1st, maybe August 25th, a little bit later. The American plum has a thicker skin and very juicy inside. The Canadian plum has a thin skin and a pulpier inside, but they both make delicious jams and jellies, and we do canned plums. I take my lightest maple syrup, and then I mix it 50-50 with water, and then I use that as like the liquid. You know, I pour over in between the plums. So I water bath can wild plums that way. Then I let it sit for like 6 months. And we pull these canned plums out and we eat them like as a dessert. But then we save that liquid and we use it to flavor fizzy water. And it's this beautiful, pink, delicious plum fizzy water. So in our house, it's a regular thing. Once a week or more, we'll say, hey, let's open a plum fizzy at dinner tonight. I love them that way. They make good fruit leather, but the plum pulp itself is sour enough that as straight up fruit leather, it's a little too strong. So we mix it at like 1/4 plum or 1/3 plum, and then the rest applesauce to make fruit leather, great fruit leather. But the best thing is at plum season, peak season, when they're totally ripe, where you just touch them and they fall off, or if you accidentally bump a bush, there's like 35 fall on the ground right away. They're just so juicy inside. And, you know, we call it sucking plum nectar. We'll just go out to our fence line where we have some great wild plums, and we'll just bite it and suck the juice out. And you know what? Just toss that seed. The flying squirrels eat the seeds. The mice eat the seeds. And we'll just gorge on plums until we're sick of them. So it's just a great wild edible.
I love it. Oh, I'm going to be looking for one of those because that sounds delicious.
And you know, they're found statewide. And almost every city has plum thickets in the city, in a park. You know, along road shoulders. I mean, you find them anywhere statewide.
How big does the fruit get?
Oh, well, that's a great question. So they're quite variable. And if you find one wild plum doesn't taste good to you and you know it's ripe, try another. They're like apples. They're highly variable. The best ones are like an inch and a half, inch and 3/4 in diameter. Actually, I'm in Eau Claire right now, and there's one near Eau Claire, east of town. I'm not going to say exactly where, a few miles. There's this along the road, there's this plum patch. Oh, they're just giant, and they're delicious. The bigger ones are like a typical domestic plum, but some of them are as small as like, you know, 5/8 of an inch, but I ignore those small ones. The average one's about an inch diameter.
Okay, yeah, they're pretty small. Good to know.
They're pretty small, but boy, when they're loaded, they are loaded. I mean, you can fill a 5-gallon bucket in a matter of 10 minutes when they're loaded.
Nice. Well, let's go back to the phones. We have a few more people waiting here. Rachel in Whitewater, go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you for answering all of our questions. You were talking about creeping Charlie and daylilies, and creeping Charlie doesn't taste good. Stay away from daylilies if you're new to foraging. What would you recommend as some plant to eat to get used to the different taste profile when foraging, so it doesn't turn people away and you can kind of build up that acquired taste?
Sure. Well, I would say that each plant is its own acquired skill and its own acquired taste. So I'm not saying beginners should stay away from daylily. I'm saying anybody with whom it disagrees should stay away. And so think of foraging not as a skill you learn. Think of it as like this kind of umbrella term, and each individual plant is its own skill. Because I could name most people wild edible plants that they already like, say red raspberry, black cap raspberries. You know, most people know those and like them, wild blueberries. And so just that idea helps people get over the idea that wild foods have strong or aversive flavors. Every flavor is kind of scary to people when it's brand new, no matter what it is. But so some of the most mildly flavored plants, like I call them gateway wild edibles. One of them that I like to recommend for people is thistle stalks. The hard part about a thistle stalk is that people tend to get them too late in the season when they're very young. There's something magical that happens when you take this plant that's essentially a weapon, and then you turn it into a vegetable. And now somebody like my brother that just doesn't like vegetables is not going to be really into a thistle stalk. But most people that like vegetables, I mean, you peel a thistle stalk at the right time, I don't care how you cook it, like, you know, people are going to like it. It's just incredibly mild and easy to eat. There's nothing objectionable about it. So when I do beginner workshops with foraging, and it's the time of year when I can peel a thistle and share it with people, that's like my go-to thing. I'm like, just wait till you see this. The world is going to seem magical. We mentioned earlier chickweed. That's a great one. It's mild. Another one coming up soon is basswood leaves. Right after the buds open, basswoods are so common, and it's just such a mild leafy green. And then again, like I mentioned, all these different wild berries, you know, there's the very well-known ones. There's some that are less well-known. But, you know, you make something good with wild berries, and people are not going to find that objectionable. So there's a lot of good gateway plants. You don't have to focus on these strong-flavored plants. But give those strong-flavored plants a few shots, you know. There's people grow up. Kids don't like beer the first few times they taste it, and then a lot of people grow up to like beer. Strong flavors take a longer time for people to grow to like them, but then they often grow to very much like strong flavors, like chocolate, all sorts of different strong things. So there's both kind of wild plants.
Okay. Well, thank you, Rachel. Appreciate that question. Let's go to Cater in Herbster. Go ahead, Cater.
Hey, Sam.
Hey, Cater.
I missed the first part of your talk because I was out roaming around, so you may have covered this, but just wondered if you're seeing anything drastic happening to the health of plant populations or phenologies due to climate change?
You know, I would say not. I would say that there are years who have been exceptionally early, a few exceptionally late years also recently. But one thing that I try to keep in mind is the plants have been here a long time through climate changes that weren't necessarily as volatile as what we're seeing now, but really great differences in climate. And most of them have broad ranges. And what was fascinating about last winter being incredibly mild was to watch how the plants reacted to a mild winter. We're used to ramps, for example, emerging as soon as the ground thaws or the snow melts. But last year, when the ground didn't freeze and there was no snow in most of the state, the ramps just waited. And I, you know, so interesting to see them behave that way, how they might behave like Kentucky in a much warmer climate. So it seems that they have the inherent ability to handle these fluctuations. But overall, I would say it doesn't seem to have a dramatic negative impact on the plants in general. But certainly like last winter, not just most recent one, but the one before, that was amazing to watch because none of us in northern Wisconsin have ever seen a winter that mild. And certainly the plants, they had to fall back on their ancient adaptations to handle totally different weather, you know, abnormal weather.
Okay, thank you so much, Cater. I appreciate that call. Now, in the last 3 minutes or so that we have, I know we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the restrictions and things that are they're happening. Now, Nicole Inshano emailed us, and she's wondering about these things, too. As more people go out and forage, how is this going to affect, you know, nature, plants, animals, et cetera? And is there a worry that public lands will be destroyed? So what's going on with Minnesota, because they've been doing some things, haven't they?
Well, Minnesota has some proposed legislation for foraging regulations on state land, and I've been in contact with the people on the foraging side of that issue regularly, and it appears those regulations are probably not going to pass. I feel like this is something that societally we need to deal with. So foraging has not been highly regulated except for the things for which there's a lot of pressure, right? And so the two things that you need a license to forage in Wisconsin are ginseng and wild rice. And I am fully in support of all necessary conservation measures and beyond what most people are thinking, not just conservation, but how do we take care of all these plants? And I think we need more people foraging so that we have people paying attention to the plants, and it's the foragers who speak up for the plants. It was wild rice harvesters that, you know, protected wild rice when it was intentionally being systematically eliminated from most of the lakes in the state 70 years ago. And it was wild rice harvesters who stopped that from happening. And so I think we need people foraging to be the eyes and the ears for the plants that we care about. Because when you eat something, you experience gratitude, and you really become the protector, the caretaker. That being said, there's always irresponsible people out there, and we need a way to deal with that. And I would advise against over-regulation, regulations that don't need to exist. And I'll say, for example, I hunt snowshoe hares. For snowshoe hare hunting in Wisconsin, there's no limit in the number that you can shoot, and there's no limit to the season. And that's because it's an abundant animal in comparison to the number of people who want to harvest it. And that's the case with most of our wild edibles. You know, nettles are not under pressure, you know, of being eliminated.
No.
Ramps are not under pressure of being eliminated, even though some people are making that claim. They are becoming more abundant, not less abundant, over the last decades. And so I think we need to pinpoint the things that need protection and not create unnecessary regulation. And that's how we manage our wildlife and our fish. And that's how we should manage our plants also. But I do think the conversation needs to happen, and foragers need to take an active part in that so that it's not regulated by people that have no stake in it, which is kind of what almost happened in Minnesota. And it's a very interesting process here. And I think those of us who forage need to really ask ourselves, what do we want and what do we need, and become involved in the process of creating those regulations. I think we have very reasonable regulations in our state parks and forests. For example, Wisconsin, we can collect berries, fruits, nuts, mushrooms for personal consumption. I don't think there's any reason people should be commercially harvesting anything on public lands. Not that it necessarily shouldn't ever happen either, but I'm comfortable with that. In our national forests, my family picks blueberries and service berries every year in the national forest, a lot that we eat, and it's not under heavy pressure. I mean, last year we had a spot, there was a square mile, there was tons of blueberries.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, we love your enthusiasm, Sam. It's catching. So thank you so much for being back with us again. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
You bet. So Sam Thayer is our guest today. If you want to find out more about his books, he's got a DVD, he teaches classes, go to foragersharvest.com. Stay with us because we've got more to come. PJ Leash will be with us to talk about insects. Thanks. Are lots of beneficial bugs in our gardens, and they can play a range of different roles. On Garden Talk today, we'll take a look at a few of them and how they work for you. I'm Jill Nadeau, glad you could join us today. PJ Leash is with us. He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab and holds degrees in biological sciences and entomology from the University of Wisconsin. Hey, PJ.
Hi, Jill.
Good to have you with us. And if you have questions about insects in your garden, maybe give us a call. Maybe you want to know how to attract the beneficial ones. The number is 642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So, PJ, anything happening in the diagnostic lab this early?
Things are relatively quiet. I've been getting a lot of questions and chatting with colleagues, and I feel it's kind of the calm before the storm here. A lot of insects are going to start popping out very, very soon. I have been looking at some of the phenological growing degree day models that can essentially predict insect emergence. And some of our kind of key go-to pests we see out in yards and gardens, for example, are going to be starting to pop out in some cases in the next week or so in southern Wisconsin. Things like maybe spongy moth, eastern tent caterpillar, we could start seeing some activity. And then from there, it's just kind of a race through into the fall almost. So a lot of stuff will pick up here in the next couple of weeks.
But it's not a cicada year, so it's not going to be quite as exciting.
Right. Yeah, the cicada situation we had last year with those 17-year cicadas, that was fun. Definitely busy for me, and I won't see those same insects again until 2041. So I've got 16 more years to get ready for it.
Yeah, well, you can watch those by yourself. I'm sure I won't be here, but I'm glad you'll be on the case. So, you know, we have talked that bad bugs tend to get all the press, but there are way more good insects, aren't there?
There are, and that is one of my roles as an extension entomologist, is to really communicate about these insects. I mean, it's human nature. The squeaky wheel gets the oil. That's the one that gets our attention. Numerically speaking, if we think about insects in the state of Wisconsin, we probably have somewhere in the ballpark of about 20,000. And the vast majority of these, you know, 90%+ are going to be beneficial in one way or another. The percentage of those that's actually like true pests, it's probably down in single digits. But again, those are the ones that really get our attention because they're munching on our vegetables or trees or shrubs in our yard. I also like to get the point across to folks that with insects, you know, we kind of anthropomorphize a little bit, and we like to label things as good or bad, but it's not that simple. There's plenty of things that insects that maybe do some good things, some bad things. A classic example of that, where context is so important, would be like paper wasps and yellow jackets later in the summer when they have their big nests. And you know, if you have a nest of those right outside your front door and they are angry when you go to pick your mail out of the mailbox, you probably need to do something about that. But if that nest is out in the back corner of your yard where you don't go, those same insects can be really good predators, and they can come into your vegetable garden or elsewhere and pick off caterpillars and other larvae and really be a beneficial insect in that regard. So again, it's not clear cut black and white, good versus bad. There's a lot of gray area as well.
Sure. Does it get a little frustrating for you knowing what you know when people just, the first thought is to just kill them, get rid of them?
It can be frustrating at times. And that's one of my jobs, is to really not only identify insects for people, but provide this broader context. What does it mean? And sometimes there are insects that we might consider pests, But if they're kind of out in your yard doing their own thing, do you necessarily need to do anything about it? In a lot of cases, I would argue no. A good example along those lines, I often argue this is the point for carpenter ants. You know, if you've got a nest in your yard and the carpenter ants are wandering into your house, you know, we maybe need to draw that line in the sand. But if they're maybe you have a wooded yard and they're just out in the woods doing their own thing, you really don't need to do anything about them.
Because we kind of forget that they're part of the whole ecosystem, right? So fewer insects, probably fewer birds and, you know, other pollinators, what have you. That's usually how it goes, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All these things are interconnected when you think about it. And, you know, when we read in the news about insect declines and things like that, it's not just insects. As you just mentioned, Jill, we have so many of our songbirds, for example, that rely on especially like larvae such as caterpillars is a food source. And so if we have insects that are declining due to our direct actions of managing pests or other things, that's not isolated in a bubble. That can affect birds and other wildlife around us. So you're exactly right, Jill. It's all interconnected.
So let's talk about pollinators first, because pollinators, they probably are getting the most good press lately. We really want to get those, especially bees and butterflies, monarchs in particular. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot more besides that do pollinating that we should probably know about, right?
Definitely, yeah. And when I say the word pollinator to a member of the general public, they jump to the insects you just mentioned, the bees and the butterflies. And for good reason, those are generally charismatic insects. I mean, who doesn't love a monarch butterfly or other butterflies? There's a lot of other things out there. And actually, it's interesting to me as an entomologist, when you think about the order Lepidoptera, this is the group of insects that includes butterflies, but numerically, most are moths. And if you look at the tree of life for that group of insects, butterflies are basically one twig that happens to be more brightly colored and day flying. But evolutionarily speaking, they're basically moths. So most of that group is moths. And people sometimes have this negative reaction of, oh, it's a moth. And butterflies are good and we love them. But, you know, don't judge a book by its cover. There are lots of moths that we are finding out are really great pollinators. The thing about it is they're active after dark in most cases. And there's a cool study. There was a PhD researcher at University of Arkansas, if I remember correctly. And I remember seeing him speak at a national entomology meeting quite a few years ago at this point. But he did this cool experiment in an orchard setting where they had fruit trees. And if you observe the fruit trees during the day, you'd see bees come, they pollinate the flowers, you'd get your apples or whatever fruit they were looking at. Then they did some things like take a mesh bag to cover the blossoms. And if they covered the blossoms at night and took them off during the day, as you'd expect, the bees come, they pollinate, you still get your fruit. Then they did the flip side of that. They covered the flowers during the day, so bees couldn't get to them. Took the bags off at night, you still got just as many fruit. It was the moths that were coming out after dark. And this hits at the point I just mentioned. It's not clear-cut good versus bad. That researcher found that some of the top and best pollinators were things like armyworms and cutworms, where the larval stages, you know, we may be concerned about them as plant pests, but the adult stages after dark were doing a great job as pollinators. So we're learning more and more about the importance of moths. And again, unless you're out with a headlamp looking at flowers after dark, people just miss that moths are doing this. There's also a long list of flies that are really great pollinators. And in some parts of the globe, like you go up into the high Arctic or alpine regions, you know, it just gets cold. Bees can have a hard time flying. And in some settings like that, flies can actually be the top pollinators. And even in temperate areas, there's plenty of fly pollinators around us. There's beetles that are pollinators and some other things as well. If an insect is hanging out on a flower, they're probably doing a little bit of pollination, be it intentional or more incidental, but there's a lot more to it than bees and butterflies.
Okay. Well, we were talking about decreasing insects, but Jim in Kenosha has a different story. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, I I've been around between Chicago and Milwaukee for decades, and I definitely got to say there's less insects, and especially in the summer. You know, when you'd be driving down the highway and you'd get about 10 pounds of protein on your windshield, it doesn't even happen anymore. And I had heard once that the insects in the world outweigh every other living animal. And then while I was listening, I also want to mention the moths pollinating, because I was in Tennessee for 12 years, and I used to watch this moth with a 6-inch wingspan in my garden if I was ever sitting out there at night just pollinating away. So thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jim. Do you know what that moth was by any chance, PJ?
Well, one guess, there's something called a white-lined sphinx moth, and this is something that can basically be found across the U.S. It's a very common species. Sometimes you'll even get these population booms where you can get just a huge increase of them. I sometimes will see that in July, for example. And this is a moth that is large enough, and if it's active during the day or evening hours, it's often mistaken for a hummingbird. Because of its size and also its behavior, it's just like a hummingbird, the way they sit and hover in front of flowers. If it was truly after dark, there's some other members of that same group we call the hawk moth or sphinx group. Some large members of that group are things like tomato and tobacco hornworms. And the adults have wingspans that are close to that range, you know, maybe in that size range of 4 or 5-ish inches. Also have that hummingbird-like behavior where they just sit there and hover right in front of a flower. They've got a mouth part called a proboscis, which is this long coiled up tube, and they will uncoil that and can stick it into flowers to drink nectar, which if you get to see that is pretty neat.
There's some hummingbird moths out there, they're hummingbird moths, right, that I've seen, and you swear they're hummingbirds, and then you look at them closer, it's like, oh no, they are not. That is an insect. And they're really cool. They're really cool. So
they are.
Yeah. So how do we attract some of these good pollinators to our garden?
Yeah, so when we talk about beneficial insects as a whole, there's kind of two main ways you could do this. One would be, in theory, a direct approach. But for homeowners, it's usually not practical. And the direct approach, what I mean by that is we do something to directly increase the numbers of a beneficial insect. So in some situations, like in agricultural settings, you can bring in a colony of honeybees or managed bumblebees. That would be a direct approach. You're purchasing the insects, you're bringing them to an area. You know, for homeowners, we generally don't have many options along those lines. In greenhouse industry, it gets used because you can contain the insects. Otherwise, the more common approach for us is kind of an indirect approach. And I call this the field of dreams approach. If you build it, they will come. If you design your landscape with a diversity of flowering plants, you will attract a wider range of pollinators, but also many of our beneficial predators and parasites will go to flowers for nectar as a fuel source. And then if you've drawn them to the area, those predators and parasites might help control some pests in your garden too. So my best piece of advice is to increase the overall diversity of flowering plants in your yard to help draw in a greater diversity of pollinators, predators, parasites, and so on. And we know from some research that can be helpful in a variety of systems, including in larger agricultural settings, where maybe a farmer has a strip of wildflowers or prairie planting, and it's drawing in some of these beneficials to help them out.
We're talking with PJ Leash. He's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. If you have questions for him, you can give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Just as a reminder, you can listen to any of our shows again online at WPR.org/Larry. You can also stream them on the WPR app, or you can download them as podcasts. So there's no way you can avoid them. We're talking about insects right now with PJ Leash. And let's go to the phones. We've got Tom in Madison. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering I have some insects here. I think they're bed bugs, but how can I get an identification? Do you have a phone? You know, I've taken pictures in the past, but you can't see them that well. Can you go down to the place, and or do you have to have an appointment? It's very confusing what one must do.
Okay, thanks, Tom. How can they get you those bugs, PJ?
Sure. Well, there's plenty of ways to get them to my lab, which is the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. If any listeners are interested, if you just do like a online search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, you should be able to find the website right away. And I've got all the instructions on there in terms of how to send in a physical sample by mail, or if someone is in the Madison area. I have folks pop in all the time to drop off samples, for example. And in some cases, if folks have digital images, and these days about 60%+ of my cases involve digital images, you're certainly welcome to send those in by email. Sometimes that's a good starting point, and if I can't tell from a photo, I'll simply request a physical sample after that. So again, feel free to hop online and search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. If you're in Madison and are familiar with campus, I'm on Linden Drive right across the street from the Babcock Hall ice cream store. So grab yourself some ice cream and then wander across the street with your insect sample. If my door is open, I'm around. Otherwise, if I'm out at the time giving a talk or traveling or something, I've got a drop box on my lab door and folks can leave a sample there, fill out a submission form. And then as soon as I'm back in, I'll take a look at that and I'll be back in touch.
Okay. Hopefully that helps you out there, Tom. We have Taryn from Toma. Go ahead, Taryn.
I just got a quick question here. It's something I've never really found a direct answer to. I'm just wondering how fireflies glow in the dark. If you could explain like the chemistry aspect of it, that would be really cool. But otherwise, what just led them to glow in the dark via evolution?
Great question, Taryn. Go ahead, PJ.
Yeah, so they contain a chemical called luciferin and then an enzyme called luciferinase. And basically it uses a molecule called ATP. This is the kind of energy currency that life uses. So our cells use ATP, other living things use ATP to basically move energy within the cell. And so they have this compound and this enzyme, use a little bit of energy, and as a biochemical reaction, you get light production for it. Now, in terms of the kind of the evolutionary reasoning for this, you know, if anyone has taken college courses on evolution or done some reading, there's a lot of interesting things that can go on related to a term called a sexual selection. You know, certain birds look a certain way so they can attract a mate. And there may be some of that going on in a case like this, where you have fireflies that are flashing as a way to communicate with others. And it's interesting, if you dig into the firefly literature, you know, if you're not trained, a lot of the flashes might look the same, but you can actually tell firefly species apart by the color of the flashes, the length of the flashes and flash patterns. And also sometimes some of the species will fly while lighting up, and that might make certain shapes, streaks or a J shape or something like that. And so that allows the insects to create these very subtle differences so that the males and females can find each other. So there's definitely some evolutionary forces there that allowed them to have this successful strategy. Not many insects do that. The light production, in contrast, a lot of insects will use chemical cues or chemical language, maybe, you know, essentially a cologne, if you think about it, or a perfume, so males and females can find each other. That's a very common strategy. But in a few cases, light can actually be used in the case of fireflies. Although I will add, not all fireflies as adults do produce light. We have some common species in the state that don't produce light, but when you look at the juvenile or larval stages, those do produce light, but it tends to be very, very faint. When I found larvae outside, you almost can't look directly at them. You almost have to look out of them from the corner of your eye.
Great. Well, thank you for that question, Taryn. If you're looking for more information, it's been a while now, but we interviewed the author of a book called Silent Sparks, The Wondrous World of Fireflies, and it's got so much information in there, and you can find that on our website if you want to listen to it. So just a little promotion there for us. Let's go back to the phones, and we've got Peggy Sue in Brilliant. Go ahead, Peggy Sue.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This really is exciting. I am kind of turned in halfway through the hummingbird moth thing, so I just wanted to make a comment on that. I also have a question for you at the end. But right now, outside of Brilliant, we have turkeys, wild turkeys chasing each other all over the place. It's really a cool time of year. But the bug thing, since I've quit using a lot of spraying pesticides, I've noticed, like, we have tons of dragonflies growing in our pond. I have hummingbird moths. They are just absolutely beautiful. I actually was able to video. I have 3 videos on my phone of them. They're one of the most wonderful little animals, creatures to see. They blew me away. I had, at one point, a whole row of Bordeaux super tunias planted. They absolutely love those. The super tunias must provide a bit of pollen for them. They went from flower to flower, and there was like 5 of them all together. My question for you, which was absolutely beautiful, but my question for you is, what kind of caterpillar should I not be damaging to get the gypsy moths? Where do they come from? Or the hummingbird moths, where did they come from?
Yeah, good question. So hummingbird moths, that group, the larvae or caterpillar, are commonly called hornworms. And so for some of the species like the tomato and tobacco hornworm, the larvae of those can actually be garden pests. They can be on your tomato plants, your pepper plants, and things like that. And they can get to be pretty good size. I mean, we're talking caterpillars that can be 3+ inches long. And as you can imagine, with caterpillars that big, sometimes those can cause some very noticeable damage to tomato plants. Now, context is kind of important. If you've got 50 tomato plants and they're chewing on a couple here or there, you're still going to have plenty of tomatoes at the end of the day. But if you have maybe a small raised bed garden like I do, and maybe 1 or 2 tomato plants, you know, then you're maybe more apt to remove them in a case like that. So there's some species that are associated with those plants, some like the white-lined sphinx moth, which is more of a day-flying species with hummingbird-like behavior. They're generally associated with some certain types of weedy plants, so not really considered a pest in that regard. Sometimes they'll even be in farm fields, but not damaging the crops. They're just feeding on some weeds that are present. So might even be considered beneficial in that regard. But each member of that family of insects, the family Sphingidae, the caterpillars will have slightly different host plants that they like to feed on. So it's kind of all over the place. What I'd encourage you to do, if you're really interested in those, there's some good books out there. For example, there's a Peterson Field Guide to Moths. And if you check that out from a local library or purchase a copy, it's not terribly expensive. You can browse through there and look at that family of the hawk or sphinx moths, and it'll tell you the host plants that they like to feed on. There's also some caterpillar field guides that'll do that too. And so that'll give you an idea of where to look for those. But as I mentioned, some of our commonest ones we see, the caterpillars are on things like tomato and pepper plants. And you know it's a hornworm because at the back end of the insect, there's a little horn-like structure. Sometimes folks think it's a stinger, but it's not. It's just this little horn-like structure. Can't harm you at all, but pretty distinctive when you see that.
Okay, great. Thanks for the question, Peggy Sue. Mary from West Jacksonport emailed us. She understands the difference between ladybugs and Asian lady beetles, but what good advice, but wants good advice on nurturing the Asian beetle to stay in her garden. She's read that they can be good, but will want to stick around and spend the winter in her house. And we certainly know that. They do love to spend the winter in the house. But are they good for the garden?
They can be, but this is a somewhat complex situation. So we obviously have this very common species. It's technically called the multicolored Asian lady beetle. And the reason for that is there's a bunch of different color forms and morphs. And if you were to line these up in a poster and look at like 15 or 20 different color morphs, you'd say those are all different species. It's the same creature, essentially. They just have these different colorations. There's also a lot of native beneficial lady beetles that are around. It's going to be really hard to specifically, you know, provide habitat or resources for just one of those, because many of our lady beetles are generalist predators that like to feed on things like aphids. And so with that said, they certainly can be considered beneficial. If you have a lot of aphids in your vegetable garden or on fruit trees or on landscape trees or shrubs, and you have these insects around, both the larval stages, the larvae, and the adults of many lady beetles are beneficial predators. So they're really helping you out in that regard. And if you read about these and learn about them, you can even train your eye to identify the clusters of eggs. A lot of insect eggs are hard to identify, but for lady beetles, they're often, they look like miniature yellow footballs, you know, really tiny, maybe a 20th of an inch tall or something like that. But you can get clusters of sometimes 15 to 20, 25 of these on plants. And so if I'm looking at a plant in my garden or elsewhere, maybe I see a lot of aphids and I'm thinking, do I need to spray? But then I do a closer look and I see eggs or larvae or adults of lady beetles. I'm probably going to hold off for a while and wait and watch and see how things kind of play out. Now, the tricky part is if you have these helping you in your garden or in your yard, there's not really a good way to get the message to them, hey, stay out of my house this fall. So in that sense, it's going to be important for you to help prevent entry into your house by something we call physical exclusion in the realm of structural pest control. That basically means making sure your house seals up nice and snug so they can't get in. So look at doors and windows, weather stripping, making sure if you have window screens, they aren't torn and stuff like that. Sometimes there may be gaps or cracks. Can you fill it in with insulation or expanding foam insulation or caulk or something like that to better seal things up? That can be helpful. Sometimes if folks really just seem to have consistent issues every fall, there are pesticide treatments that could be considered. And you're not blanket spraying the entire outside of your structure. You spray little strips around potential entry points, doors and windows. We're talking about a strip maybe an inch wide or something like that. And the idea is those products have repellency. So if they try to get in, it irritates them and they leave and they stay outdoors. That may help you out. But in a lot of cases, if you're able to tolerate them or they're not getting in high numbers, they can do some definitely good things in your garden. On the flip side, they're not native. We have some other non-native lady beetle species. Sometimes those Asian lady beetles, they can actually be a little bit bigger. And so they may be, to a certain extent, outcompeting some of our native ladybugs or lady beetles because they're a little bit bigger. You know, if two different species show up to feed on aphids, the bigger one's probably going to basically elbow the other one out of the way. So that could occur to a certain extent as well. So as I said, it's a very complex issue. It's not just good or bad. It really depends on a lot of details.
Well, you know, earlier we had talked about pollinators, but there's some other insect classifications that we wanted to talk about too. And the next one we would say are predators and parasites. So we talked a little bit about that, but why don't you tell us a little bit more about them and you know, why they're important.
Yeah, so there's a lot of insects out there in the state and around the world that are really beneficial predators and parasites in some cases. Now, in terms of predators, we have some very common ones around here that folks have probably seen. Like if you go outdoors during the warmer months, it's dark, you see an ovalish beetle on the ground, there's a good chance it's a member of the family Carabidae. These are the ground beetles. And these can be really good predators feeding on a lot of insects, often on the ground or ground level. There's even some larger members of that group. There's one called the fiery searcher that will actually climb all the way up into canopy of oak trees to feed on like spongy moth caterpillars, and spongy moth used to be called gypsy moth. So that can be very beneficial in that regard. There are predatory flies like robber flies that kind of behave like dragonflies. They can catch things in midair. I've seen some cool pictures of them like capturing a Japanese beetle and then sitting there and feeding on it. So very beneficial in that regard. there's a whole bunch of ambush predators out there. These are things that just wait. Maybe they're waiting on a plant or a flower. There's assassin bugs that do this. There are some spiders, like crab spiders, that do this. Now, keep in mind, these are often generalist predators, so they may be grabbing some pests. But if you ever look at a flower and there's, say, a butterfly hanging off at a weird angle, like upside down, it might have fallen prey to one of these ambush predators. So the lines of good versus bad kind of get blurred here when that goes on. But lots and lots of beneficial predators out there. Another one that's one of my personal favorites are lacewings, and we've all probably seen these. There's green lacewings, which will readily come to like your porch or deck lights at night. Vibrant neon green, maybe a half inch, three quarters of an inch long, very delicate lace-like wings, hence the name lacewing. They're beneficial. They'll feed on aphids, other small insects as adults. The larvae, though, are very, very fierce predators. And you can actually train yourself to identify the eggs of lacewings. For some species and types, they're this little whitish egg, but they're raised up on a thin, translucent stalk. And I see these all the time in my yard. Sometimes they're on the side of my house or on the cover of my grill or on plants. But if I'm looking at a plant and I have aphids present, but I'm seeing lots of eggs around, that tells me the cavalry is very soon going to arrive and help with that. So lots of predators out there. There's also parasites, which tend to get overlooked because they're often small or folks just aren't quite sure what to look for. There are hundreds, thousands of species of very tiny parasitic wasps. And if we've seen the old Aliens movie with Sigourney Weaver, there's that scene where they're sitting around the table and the alien bursts out. That, you know, it's a science fiction movie. That's basically taken from the realm of entomology. That's what these wasps and parasites do. They develop internally inside other insects. And they're very good at what they do. They don't eat the critical tissues first, like the brain. They save those. They keep their host alive and fresh, consume it from the inside. And I've seen situations where there's lots of them that will go after aphids. I'll look at a plant and there's aphids present, but the ones that have been parasitized, the aphids are off color. They're usually beige. They remain in this plump, kind of expanded shape, but you can look at them and tell something is not right. And sometimes you'll see actually a little hole. That's where the wasp adult has completed its development and chewed a little escape hatch and come out. So I've seen situations where I look at a plant and 80, 90-plus percent of the aphids have been parasitized. That tells me I don't want to spray anything. If I do, it might actually backfire and take out the good guys that are there, so to speak. So there's plenty of wasps that do that, that go after aphids and other insects. Sometimes folks will bump into that similar situation in garden. There's a type of wasp that attacks hornworm caterpillars. They feed internally, but when they're ready to pupate, they go to the outside of the caterpillar. They spin little whitish cocoons, and so you can have a hornworm where there are literally dozens or hundreds of these cocoons. Now, the caterpillar is still alive at this point, but not for much longer. And there's also some flies that do this from the family Tachinidae. And what they do is they tend to lay a white egg or two or three, usually right behind the head of the insect they're going to parasitize. So I've bumped into Japanese beetles and various caterpillars where you look at them and you see a little white egg and you say, that insect's going to be a goner here very soon. So when you start diving into that, there's an amazing diversity of insect parasites that are out there, but they tend to go overlooked because they're very, very small creatures.
It really is science fiction sounding, but it's real. And then the last class that we wanted to look at were the decomposers, which kind of sounds like a great rock band name. But what do they do?
I think of them as nature's recyclers or garbage men. They are providing and any time a beneficial insect does something for us, we refer to that as an ecosystem service. It's something Mother Nature does so that we don't have to. So this is often overlooked, kind of taken for granted. But we know, you know, when the leaves fall off the trees and fall, they don't just accumulate and pile up over years and years. Things eat them, break them down. So that can be things like earthworms, of course, but there's a very, very long list and amazing diversity of insects that are decomposers. Another name for them is sometimes detritivores, but they're helping break down fallen plant material, decomposing plant material, rotting logs, animal remains. So they feed on it. They break those material down. Those nutrients are getting returned into the soil and into the ecosystem. And so they're really helping us out in that regard. A classic example of this, everyone's heard of these dung beetles. You know, we're the dairy state. We have cows. You have cows, you're going to have manure. That's a fact of life. And if things like dung beetles and various flies break those materials down and those nutrients then get into the pasture, other area, you know, it's the circle of life that's helping things out. And even in your own garden, you can have lots of things. Some are insects, some not. Pill bugs, millipedes and stuff like that are helping feeding on break down some of these things. Slugs can do that to a certain extent. Earwigs and lots of other insects will help break down those organic materials so that it doesn't accumulate forever. And also it's returning some of those nutrients into the ecosystem, be it our garden bed or our yard.
We are talking with PJ Leash. He's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Do you have a question for him? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Join in with your questions. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Najoe. Please join us on the Larry Mueller Show on Monday. We're going to talk to sports journalist Pete Doherty about his impressions of this week's draft in Green Bay. And then we'll talk about training for a marathon. And in the last hour, we'll hear from the weather guys, which is always fun. Right now, we are talking about insects. We've got another phone call. So Elizabeth and Nina, what's your question?
Hi, I grew up with a love of bees, and I would love to have a small hive, but I live in the suburbs. This would not be for commercial purposes. I just am hesitant to just buy bees off of the internet because I wouldn't want to bring in a species that isn't good for Wisconsin or my area. How do I find the right source? Obviously, the vendors are going to say they're fine for my location, but I would want to know. How do people do that?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts on that. When it comes to like bees in your yard, I mean, the first question I'd have for you is if you have an idea of what sort of bees you'd like to have. Are we talking honeybees? Or in some cases, you can purchase wild bees such as mason bees, for example, or sometimes maybe certain types of leafcutter bees. Those can be possibilities as well. A thought along the lines of honeybees is if that's something that you're interested in, honeybees, the price of obtaining them has really gone up over the last 15 to 20 years. Honeybee populations can sometimes fluctuate wildly, and so costs have gone up across the board. So don't be surprised if getting a honeybee colony can easily cost you $200 or more, and then all the equipment you need to get on top of it as well. If you're really interested in that, a general suggestion would be to contact your local beekeeping club. Throughout the state and usually around the country, there's often county-based or sometimes multi-county beekeeping clubs, and that's a great way to learn, maybe spend some time with other beekeepers and see and learn from their experience. Sometimes they're willing to have you out and just see how they do things in their own bee yard, so that can be a great experience. Another thing that can be really helpful with honeybees, if you're interested, is to check with your local municipality in terms of if there are rules allowing you to do that, or in some cases they may say you can't do that. Sometimes it just hasn't been something that's come up before, and so there's no rules. So reach out to your alderperson or someone else in the municipality to see if that's okay. If you're interested in like mason bees, leafcutter bees, and things like that, you know, I'd really encourage you to hop online, do some searching for more reputable, you know, larger companies that's the only thing that they do. If it's someone posting on like Craigslist, you know, you don't necessarily know the species and things like that. So that's a little bit different. I know there's some I've heard of like crown bees and elsewhere where you can obtain things like mason bees, leafcutter bees. Another thought though is simply if you'd like to have, say, mason bees or leafcutter bees or some of these other wild bees in your yard, you don't necessarily have to purchase them to introduce them. They may be in the area. You might be able to encourage them in your own yard by having the types of plants that they like. And there's some good books out there about attracting these to your yard, what sorts of plants to put in, but also providing the resources that they need in terms of nesting sites. If you hop online and read about bee houses or bee hotels, you can buy various kits. It's essentially things like cardstock tubes that are the right diameter that they will go to as a nesting site. So that's something else that you could look into. That'd be more of the indirect route, but can still be pretty successful. I mentioned and made this analogy earlier, the Field of Dreams approach. If you put out what they need, they're probably in the area and they can find it too.
Okay, thank you, Elizabeth. We got an email from Renee. She's wondering if you can talk about how detrimental the mosquito spray is and even the natural versions. She says people spray their entire yard. And what kind of environment do fireflies need to increase their population? And then finally, she's got a lot of questions here. Where have the Luna moths gone? She says she doesn't see them anymore. So first up is the mosquito spray.
Yeah, so mosquito spraying is something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And there's different approaches in terms of how you can go about managing mosquitoes. And sometimes we'll drive down the road and see signs for residential yard treatments and that sort of thing. If you simply hop online and search for the question, do mosquito sprays harm bees or butterflies or beneficial insects? You sometimes get into the literature that talks about treatments that are considered ULV or ultra low volume treatments. These are the sorts of treatments that are generally done by like aircraft or big devices on backs of trucks and things like that. And what those treatments do is they produce exceedingly small droplets that can take out mosquitoes. But what happens is this is a very, very short-lived type of treatment. Basically, those tiny droplets dissipate. We also know from some of the physics involved that insects with body masses larger than mosquitoes generally don't seem to be impacted much, if at all, by those treatments. And so if a treatment is done like that, it's done in the evening when a lot of mosquitoes are active. We know the impacts of that are relatively low. But again, within a few hours, it dissipates and there's no residual protection. So in theory, mosquitoes could blow in the next day and you'd have them back in an area. There's, on the flip side of that, not much research out there that's been done at this point on the residual yard treatments. That's where a company comes in, or you could do it yourself. But you're basically using a backpack type sprayer that'll make it looks like a mist. Compared to the ULV treatments, though, I just mentioned, the droplets are much bigger. And the idea with these treatments for yard treatments is you get the droplets onto a plant, and then it's going to last for some period of time, usually several weeks, maybe a month or so, depending on the product or formulation. The thought is if mosquitoes land on the plants to rest, they will contact it, they will be killed by it, and that would help with the mosquito situation. Now, a caveat is that the common treatments that are used for this, if you look at the label, you can use them at the same rates to control pests like Japanese beetles and lots of other things in our yards. And so my concern is if people are doing this, say, every single month to all the trees and shrubs and greenery in their yard, you could be coating those plants with an insecticide that isn't specific to mosquitoes. It has a broad spectrum of activity. And so when I think about other insects that land on those plants or use those plants, that could be things like leafcutter bees, like butterflies, like fireflies, and lots of other things that land on those plants, they could be impacted. Now, again, there's not a whole lot of research at this point. I'd love to see more. I have seen a few studies, though. There is one done by one of my former colleagues who's now retired, Dr. Karen Oberhauser, and she was a worldwide monarch butterfly expert. She did a simulated mosquito treatment to some milkweed plants, would put monarchs on those plants at set points in time. And, you know, if you treat a plant, you put a monarch on it right after that, of course, you know, it's not going to be good for the monarch. But what she found in her study is you could be putting monarchs on a week or 2 weeks or some point down the line, and it could still harm them. And so with that said, I do have concerns about these yard type treatments, especially if they're done all season long, because you're not just harming mosquitoes. The potential exists to be harming all sorts of other insects, including what leads into our second question, which is fireflies. We know they like to land on plants and sit there and flash. And so if you have those treatments on plants and fireflies land there, it's probably not going to be a good thing for them. Now, the caller's question was, how can we kind of increase fireflies? What do they need? In general, they need moisture and they need plants. And so if you are in an area that is really big and open and generally pretty dry, maybe a really sandy area, sandy soil, probably not going to be great habitat for fireflies. Some of the best area that I've personally seen in the state is when I get down into like stream valleys, river valleys. You know, you drive through some of the parts of the Driftless in southwestern Wisconsin. You have valleys that hold in moisture, lots of plants, wooded area and stuff like that. Those meadow areas can be great habitat for fireflies. So in general, if you want more fireflies, you'd want to like decrease pesticide use in your yard, increase overall vegetation. In a lot of cases, fireflies like the same kind of habitat as slugs, and firefly larvae can actually feed on slugs and be beneficial in that regard. So, you know, if you've got dense woods and lots of slugs in areas like that, or meadows with lots of slugs, that's probably some good firefly habitat too, but they need those damp conditions. And then lastly, Luna moths. We know for both Luna moths and some of our other giant silk moths, as we call them from that group, it's harder to find these over time. There could be a number of factors going on. Land use changes, you know, they really like larger areas of like contiguous woodlots, forests and stuff like that versus individual trees and yard. You're just not giving them a lot of habitat. You still could have them potentially. And so if you live near a wooded area, you're probably more likely to see them than in a city or suburban area, unless maybe you back up to a woodlot. So that's one factor. We also have some complications from things like artificial lighting at night, which we refer to as an acronym of ALAN, A-L-A-N. And in some of the insect decline literature, that's been pointed at is playing a role in this. Because if moths like Luna moth and other things, they're trying to go about do their business of finding mates at night. And if instead they're distracted flying to a light, that reproductive capacity or potential decreases. They're just not as successful. And so that's probably harming them as well. So if I wanted to go find Luna moths, I would probably go to western part of the state or more northern areas, wooded areas, have fewer lights on at night. I'm going to have a better chance finding them in situations like that.
Okay. Thank you for all those questions, Renee. And let's, I think we have probably time for one more question. Jeremy in Madison, go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I really enjoy macro photography and like taking pictures of insects. And I live in the city, and I was wondering if you have any suggestions for where to find subject for photographs, and also things to be mindful of as to not disturb, you know, the life cycle of the insects. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, insects can be found absolutely everywhere. So we mentioned this earlier, things are just kind of starting getting going for the season. Once plants start leafing out and a lot more flowers coming out, it'll be a lot easier to find insects. So any park or wooded area you can go to, it should be easy to find plenty of insect subjects. You know, just in Madison area, a place like the Arboretum could be a great location because you have an amazing diversity of plants there. If you're close to campus, you go down on the Lakeshore Path, Picnic Point, Frouchy Point, and so on, could be some great areas there. But, you know, any city, county park, something like that, if there's a prairie area, wildflower area, there can be a lot of insects there to spot. In terms of, you know, not disrupting them, if you're trying to photograph insects, I go out with a nice macro lens and I try to move generally kind of slowly so you're less likely to startle and spook them and have them fly off. And that still happens plenty of cases too, or they just don't cooperate with you. Sometimes if you are trying to really get a picture of a particular insect, you could temporarily capture it in like a Tupperware. And I know insect photographers will do this. They'll put that down on like a white sheet of paper. Just wait for a while till the insect kind of mellows out and calms down and stops moving. Very carefully take the Tupperware off so you can take your pictures and then release it when you're done. So I've heard of some insect photographers using tricks like that. And also if you have enough daylight, probably avoiding flashes. Sometimes you need that for macro photography, but the flash might just be enough to startle them and cause them to move off.
Okay, well, thank you for that question, Jeremy. I don't think we've ever gotten that one, PJ. That's a good one.
Yeah, good questions today.
Definitely. And then for those who are interested, again, how do they contact you for questions? Because we didn't get to everybody today. So.
Sure. Yeah. If anyone ever wants to reach out to me, I run the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. I work here on the UW-Madison campus, but I have statewide responsibilities. So easiest thing to do would probably be to hop on Google or another search engine and just look for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. Should be able to find my website pretty easily. I've got all my contact info on there, information on how to send in digital photos or video clips, or if you want to send in a physical sample by mail or drop it off, I've got all the instructions for that too.
Great. Thank you so much. And PJ will be back with us on Wednesday, May 21st from 11 until 12:30. So you can ask then. For the Larry Mueller Show, I'm Jill Nadeau. Thank you so much for listening.